Hi everybody, happy birthday to us. Fallacious Trump is 3, and this is the third and last of the birthday presents that we're giving to you during our very brief time off. And this is the audio from the Skeptics in the Pub talk that I gave a couple of months ago about my work as a film censor, essentially, film examiner for the British Board of Film Classification. So there's information behind the scenes, how the film censorship in the UK got set up and how it worked when I was there. And there's a Q&A session as well. The session is introduced and the Q&A session is run by Dave Jenkins from Coventry Skeptics in the Pub. So thanks very much, Dave, for letting us post this. And also thanks to Skeptics in the Pub. The Skeptics in the Pub in throughout the country and in fact throughout the world have had to stop their in-person events during the pandemic. But a bunch of them got together to create Skeptics in the Pub online. So every Thursday there is a talk at twitch.tv/SITP, and they're on scientific, critical thinking, sceptical subjects, or subjects that the organisers think would be interesting to people who are into that kind of stuff. And they are absolutely fascinating talks. I haven't seen one yet that hasn't been amazing. And there's an opportunity to ask questions, and then afterwards there's a kind of virtual pub to go and chat with the other people in the group about the talk and just about general life, really, and kind of get to know some people. So I very, very strongly recommend going along to a Skeptics in the Pub online talk. Meanwhile, I hope you enjoy this one, and we will be back next week with our regularly scheduled Fallacious Trump episode.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Skeptics in the Pub online. My name is Dave, and I'm from Coventry Skeptics in the Pub. Coventry is just one of the many groups that at the beginning of the pandemic decided to work together to put on weekly talks based around science, reason, and critical thinking. If you like what we're doing, then you can make a donation on PayPal at sitp.online/donate. The link is on the screen, and our lovely mods will put the link into the chat. Tonight, we'll start with the talk. We will then have a 15-minute break, then have a Q&A. If you want to ask a question of the speaker, then you can go to sitp.online/ask, and you can also upvote for the questions that you would most like to hear answered. After the Q&A, we'll have our weekly virtual pub, the Lock-ins Razor, on Zoom, where you can all come and have a chat. Our talk tonight has closed captions, which you can turn on by pressing the CC button underneath the video. Please ask a mod in the chat if you're struggling with that. Tonight's talk will contain references to sexual violence and animal cruelty. There are no images, but some viewers may find this disturbing. Tonight's speaker is Jim Cliff. He was a British Board of Film Classification examiner from 2001 to 2009, during which time he classified over 7,000 films, videos, and video games. He's now a freelance video producer and host of the Fallacious Trump podcast. Please put your virtual hands together for Jim.
Thanks very much. So, our story starts in May of 1897. It's a year and a half since the Lumiere brothers created their combined camera and projector and presented the first public screening of a motion picture. Their motion pictures are now the kind of most exciting new big thing, and there's a huge annual charity event in Paris where they decide to have a screening of a film in a large wooden warehouse. Unfortunately, the projection equipment catches fire, and there is a fire which causes basically over 120 people are killed in the fire. And this is the most significant, one of the most significant, but by no means the last fire involving film. The reason that fire happened, and the reason lots of fires happened over the ensuing decades, was that celluloid, or cellulose nitrate, is basically an explosive. It is extremely flammable. It'll burn even if you put it in underwater. And in order to project a film onto a screen, you need to run that celluloid pretty close to a very bright, and in those days that meant very hot, bulb. So fires became reasonably common, and on top of that, there weren't really any custom-built cinemas at the time. So some theatres and music halls had been converted to be cinemas, but most films were shown in kind of temporary structures, in fairgrounds, churches, and even hastily converted shops like this one in Stratford. Whereas you can see from the headline, they had a fire in 1908. So health and safety was clearly an issue. And this led to, in 1909, the Cinematograph Act, which gave local councils the responsibility to license buildings where films could be shown. And initially, that was all to do with health and safety. But over the next few years, some councils started to use it to justify restricting cinema opening times, sometimes even restricting which films could be shown or who could go and see them. And there was absolutely no consistency across the UK. It was kind of done council by council. The film industry started, not unreasonably, to worry about censorship, especially because in 1912, the Daily Mail started getting upset about a film called From the Manger to the Cross, which they were upset about it just because it was about the life of Christ. It wasn't particularly contentious or problematic. They just felt that that was sacrilegious and shouldn't be allowed. And the Daily Mail will come back later. But basically, because of that, and the film industry were worried about the possible intervention of government censorship, and they decided that they would set up their own self-regulating body. So in 1912, they decided to do that. And at the beginning of 1913, the British Board of Film Censors was born. It was a non-profit, non-governmental organization, which was funded from the fees that they charged to the film industry. In the beginning, that was £2 per reel of film, and a reel is about 20 minutes of film. It's still charged in that way, and where people still submit films, it's charged by the foot. Most of it's digital these days, and obviously with video, it's digital, so that's charged by the minute. In the beginning, there were two male examiners, and by the 1920s, there were four examiners, one of whom was a woman. Those examiners were not part of the film industry. The idea from the very beginning was to keep it independent from the industry. And the classifications were done on behalf of local councils. So the local councils still theoretically had the right to restrict various things about cinemas, including who got to go in to see films. But by the mid-20s, essentially most of them just rubber-stamped the BBFC decisions, and it kind of became consistent across the whole country. And that's actually still the case today. That's how it works. All the councils still have the right to make their own decisions. And the BBFC is just the authority that kind of gives them that information, and they mostly rubber stamp those decisions. The Licensing Act of 2003 did designate the BBFC as the body for doing that, but it didn't take away the responsibility of councils essentially to be the kind of final arbiter. And so that's why in Torquay, Monty Python's Life of Brian was banned in the 70s, even though the BBFC gave it a category. And that actually wasn't overturned until 2008, when someone resubmitted it to the council because they wanted to show it in a film festival. It was banned in various other places in the 70s as well. And it's also, that's why Westminster Council banned Crash, despite the BBFC giving it an 18. And it's also why lots of local councils gave Mrs. Doubtfire and Spider-Man PG when the BBFC gave them both 12. So in the beginning, there were only two categories. There was U, which is universal, suitable for everyone, and there was A, which was supposedly suitable for adults. But actually, there was no restriction. There was nothing to stop children being taken in. And it was only a couple of councils that actually decided, again, in the 20s, to make that an advisory category, make it an accompanied category, essentially, that where if you wanted to take a child in under 16, you could, but they couldn't go in on their own. But for the most part, again, there was no consistency across the UK, and it was really just to let people know. It was information. In 1932, they added an H category. This was for horror films. And that was because basically 1931, Dracula and Frankenstein were released. People got a bit upset. And so the BBFC decided to put an H on horror films and let people know that arguably they were even less suitable for children in some cases. Again, it wasn't mandatory, although some councils decided to restrict people going into horror films to 16 and above. But for the most part, there was really no explanation from the board why they gave different films different categories or why they cut things. And it was kind of largely on the whim of the examiners. The first information that we really have about what was cut and what fed into category decisions was from 1916, when the second president of the board, T.P. O'Connor, went through all of the annual reports for the board's first couple of years, and basically listed all of the things that films had been cut for, or in some cases rejected for. Those included some things that these days would be a bit less of an issue, like bathing scenes passing the limits of propriety or references to controversial politics. But it also included some things that even today are still considered for cuts, even at 18, including cruelty to animals and the modus operandi of criminals, both of which we'll come back to a bit later. But again, there was still really no accountability, no transparency. And there were some kind of, not necessarily controversial, but just whimsical decisions that were made. In 1928, there was a film called The Seashell and the Clergyman. It was a surrealist film. And the Examiner's report says it is apparently meaningless, but if there is a meaning, it is doubtless objectionable. So that was what distributors were dealing with. There were no written rules. And because of that, basically the direction that the board took at any point in the next few decades were guided very much by the idiosyncrasies of the people who were in charge at any given time. The chief censor after the Second World War, Arthur Watkins, his main problem was the rise in teenage culture, youth culture, and the rebelliousness and anti-authoritarianism that came with it. He dealt with Rebel Without a Cause. He also dealt with The Wild One in 1954. The way he dealt with that was that he rejected it, because as far as he was concerned, he said it was a spectacle of unbridled hooliganism. And in fact, that film didn't get a certificate until 1967. Under Arthur Watkins, they introduced also an X category. X basically took the place of H, because by that point, by the 50s, the kind of horror fad had largely died out. H hadn't been used for that many films, as it turned out. But X was made a mandatory category. So that meant that people under 16 could not go into X-rated films. And it was used, obviously, not just for horror, but for anything that was considered more adult, more kind of sex and violence stuff was allowed in those than were allowed in films rated A. John Trevelyan took over as secretary at the time. That was the name for the chief censor at the time in the late 50s. He presided over somewhat of a liberalization of the board. He was in place when the Obscene Publications Act came in 1959, which was almost immediately successfully challenged by the book Lady Chatterley's Lover. And he saw this as the beginning of a shift of public views of morality through the 60s, really. It was his opinion that the BBFC cannot assume responsibility for the guardianship of public morality. So it was under Trevelyan that we got the first use of fuck in film in Ulysses in 1967, the first full frontal female nudity in Blow Up, and the first full frontal male nudity in Women in Love. Trevelyan also oversaw an overhaul of the rating system in 1970. U was still suitable for all. A was downgraded to basically what we now think of as PG. So it was definitely an advisory category. It was just saying the thing, it's not really suitable for the youngest children. There was a new category introduced called AA, which required adult accompaniment for any child under the age of 14. And X was moved from 16 to 18 at that point, but was still a mandatory category. One of the most idiosyncratic and probably most controversial censors was James Furman. He presided over an extremely busy period at the board. He was a controversial figure. He very much enjoyed being a part of the film industry and the power that he had in his role. He personally flew to LA to help Steven Spielberg cut Raiders of the Lost Ark for PG. But among film fans, one of the things he's probably best known for is his stance on weapons. The year before James Furman took over, Enter the Dragon came out. And it kind of ushered in an era of martial arts. It was at the beginning of the wave of martial arts films that became very popular. Furman noticed a few newspaper articles and reports that talked about teenagers getting interested in martial arts and possibly even carrying martial arts weapons. And he decided that this was something that needed to be cracked down on. So he instituted a blanket ban on nunchucks, which is what Bruce is holding here, Bruce Lee, and throwing stars as well. So all of the martial arts films that came out in that period were heavily cut if they contained these things. And it also led to some quite weird classification decisions in the ensuing decades. There was a Jean-Claude Van Damme film in the 80s called No Retreat, No Surrender. As you can see from this scene, there is a poster on the wall of Bruce Lee holding nunchucks. That's actually from Enter the Dragon. All sight of this poster in the film was cut. That isn't as ridiculous as it got, though, because then in 1991, the sequel to Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, Secret of the Ooze, came out. And Michelangelo wielded sausages, basically, sausages that had been strung together with a bit of rope as nunchucks. And that was also cut. And I think at that point, even people who had kind of previously had some sympathy for Furman's stance on these kinds of weapons, even they thought this was a bit ridiculous. After Furman left in 1999, the ban was completely rescinded, and it came very much then down to glamorization of easily accessible weapons like knives and things like that, that was more likely to get cut. Martial arts weapons were in many cases reinstated if those films were ever resubmitted for classification. Under Furman, there was another overhaul of the rating system, this time to basically the one that we know today. So there was U, PG for parental guidance, 15 and 18. And the 15 and the 18 were mandatory categories. Then the 12 category was added in 1989. Batman was the first film rated 12 in the cinema. There was still no 12 on video until 1994. And then much later on in 2002, the 12 in cinema changed to 12A, which meant that people under 12 were allowed in if they were accompanied by a grown-up. Another significant change that was made under James Furman was the shift in the name from the British Board of Film Censors to the British Board of Film Classification. And this basically, as far as Furman was concerned, this represented the job that they did much better. And it's true, he really did make that change in the ethos of the board as well, because when he came in 1974, 40% of all cinema films were cut. And when he stepped down in 1998, there was that was down to 4%. These days, it's much closer to 1%. And the vast majority of those are category cuts, where the company has requested a specific category. So, but by far the most important, significant thing that happened during James Furman's reign was the rise of video. In 1979, VCRs were first sold in the UK. This is the Ferguson VideoStar. It's the one I had as a kid. And in the late 70s and early 80s, you could buy or rent basically any video you liked in Woolworths, WH Smiths, on the high street, anywhere. There was no restriction, no classification, no censorship. And there was an influx of fairly strong horror films, largely from Europe, that capitalized basically on this kind of open market. One such film was Cannibal Holocaust. And the makers of Cannibal Holocaust had a brilliant idea in terms of promoting their film. What they did was they sent a copy of the film and a letter complaining about it to Mary Whitehouse. If you don't know who Mary Whitehouse is, this is her. She was the kind of self-appointed head of the National Viewer and Listener Association, and her mission was to clean up film and television, to get it kind of get rid of all that nasty sex and violence. The hope by the makers of Cannibal Holocaust was that she would make a fuss about it, it would get lots of publicity, and they would sell lots of copies of their film. It wasn't an inherently bad idea. In the 90s, when the first Grand Theft Auto video game came out, Rockstar, the makers of Grand Theft Auto, hired Max Clifford, the publicist, to basically kick up a fuss about how awful this game is and how demonic it is, and it was going to ruin everyone's lives. And that got a lot of publicity, and Grand Theft Auto became the biggest game of the year. So the idea itself wasn't necessarily bad, but it didn't really work out for Cannibal Holocaust. Mary Whitehouse did kick up a bit of a fuss about it. The Daily Mail took up the fight, and MPs got involved. The Daily Mail had a campaign against what came to be called video nasties. The Director of Public Prosecutions made a list of 70 videos that they had either already prosecuted under the Obscene Publications Act or had prosecutions pending against them. And police were sent out to raid video shops, essentially to seize any copies of anything that was on the list and ultimately destroy them. And what ultimately came out of this was the Video Recordings Act of 1984. And that was the law that designated the BBFC to classify any video that was sold or rented in the UK. So for the first time, the BBFC had an actual legal basis for the work that they were doing. They were designated in law to do this job. And from that point on, no video or DVD, as once DVDs came along, was able to be sold or rented in the UK without already having a BBFC classification, except for some very narrow exempt categories. One of the very last things that James Furman did before he left was draft a set of written guidelines. And this was the first time that the board had written guidelines, and they were published in the annual report of 1998. They were basically still James Furman's ideas of how things should be done. They just laid out what he already said and what he expected, the rules he expected his examiners to follow at the time. But they were in public for the first time, and that was kind of totally new. And it did talk about kind of what words were considered mild, medium, you know, strong, coarse language, that kind of thing, and what level of sex violence and drug use and things were accepted at different categories. And the bare bones of the guidelines have kind of lived through to today's versions of guidelines. They're still laid out in much the same way. His job was then taken over by Robin Duval in 1999, he wanted to usher in, as well as having written guidelines, a new era of kind of openness, accountability, and transparency to the board. And one of the first things he did was create a public consultation process. So rather than just decide what he thought or what the examiners thought people should do or people should be allowed to see, he started up a process where we would actually go out to the public, find out what they wanted. And these numbers here are from the most recent version, because that has been repeated every 4 or 5 years since then. And a new set of guidelines has been written each time in response to the views that the public have given us. And so in doing that process, they gathered a combination of qualitative and quantitative data. They did focus groups, questionnaires, town halls. They did a thing called citizens' juries, which is where they got a smaller group of people. They brought them in for 4 days, had experts in film, psychology, and examiners and people like that talking to them about all the issues that they faced, showing them clips of what they considered 12 level sex, 15 level sex, violence, drug use, and so on, and asked them what they thought about it, why they thought that, whether they thought, and this is in the questionnaires as well, whether they thought the board was being too lenient or too strict at different levels. And they collated all of this information in the first public consultation, which was at the time the largest public consultation exercise that had ever been undertaken by a content regulator anywhere in the world. They had about 4,000 people. In subsequent ones, it was anywhere between 8 and 12,000. And they gathered all of this information together, and along with their own experience and information from experts in various fields, they wrote a second set of guidelines in 2000. And those were based on the results they got from that first public consultation. And this is where I come in. I joined the board in 2001. I was an examiner for 8 years. These are some of the examiners I worked with. They're a fairly diverse group, all different kinds of ages, genders, backgrounds, languages spoken, because sometimes we would get films in particularly South Asian or East Asian languages. The backgrounds, it was a really kind of conscious effort by the board to hire people from different backgrounds. There were doctors, lawyers, teachers, journalists, filmmakers, authors, civil servants. So it was a truck driver, a parole officer, magistrate, people who had previously worked in broadcasting, people who were from similar regulatory organizations in different countries. And what they really didn't want is to have everyone who thought the same way and approached problems in the same way, because one of the really important parts of what we did was debate. We would have an issue that turned out to be on the borderline between two categories, and the fact that we came from it from different angles, saw it differently, and that meant that we could have a discussion about it. We could look at all of the different issues instead of everyone just all being the same and thinking the same way. It was really important, and I think a very useful part of why the board's decision making did begin after they started doing public consultations, to really reflect the kind of views of the public rather than kind of impose those views on them. So when I joined, I was trained for 3 months before being involved in a single classification decision. I was trained by examiners who'd been there for years, and as time went on, I trained other examiners. A lot of that training involved learning, obviously, about the classification issues that we faced, but also about the laws that those classifications were based on, the kinds of things that had been cut in the past. Most of it really was about precedent. Because if you think about it, a person who has, a 12-year-old kid, and they watch with their child PG or 12-rated films, perhaps, or even you, they get a sense of what to expect from those categories. and whether they're okay with their kids seeing that stuff and hearing that language and that kind of stuff. So part of it is not subverting that expectation of the public, not having things in those films that they would be upset or have a problem with their children seeing when they've got used to knowing what's in those categories. And there's a lot of data that says that the British public, parents specifically, do pay a lot of attention to what the categories are, certainly at the lower ages. And so a lot of that training was watching films that had set those precedents. Sometimes it was just clips of stuff that was relevant and that was a borderline issue. And we looked at why those decisions had been made at the time, how they fitted in with the guidelines. And we were given a list of quite a thick stack, actually, of films to watch that were important in previous classification decisions. Obviously, everyone coming into this role is already a big film fan. So a lot of the films we'd already seen, but there was a lot of that kind of 3 months was spent watching things we hadn't seen or kind of refreshing our knowledge of things that we'd seen, perhaps sometimes quite a lot. So the day-to-day work of actually examining once we'd got through that training process was obviously involved a lot of viewing. So for 3.5 days a week, we viewed material, and that was 5.5 to 6 hours a day. It didn't look like this. This is actually a couple of real examiners doing the job. And while we watched, we would be taking notes. And what we got to see in that 5.5, 6 hours a day was completely random. It was assigned to us by a different department. We didn't get to choose what we watched. It could be, it always was a mixture of all kinds of different things. It could be, you know, a few hours of Teletubbies, porn, wrestling, maybe a video game, an episode of The X-Files. Sometimes we got to go down to the cinema in the basement and watch a film that was going to be released in cinemas. There weren't snacks, unfortunately. That's set up for a press screening, that image. But basically, you didn't know until the day before, really, what you were going to be viewing. When I was at the board, many things were viewed in pairs. The only things that were viewed solo were things that had already been classified. So, for example, if something had been released in the cinema and then it came in to be released on video, that was viewed solo. And stuff that had already been on TV was usually solo as well. But everything else was viewed in a pair. And at the end of watching each item, we would discuss what we thought the category should be and why. And that could go a number of ways. For the most part, usually the two of us agreed. And then at the end of the day, we would write our reports. We would use our notes to make a list of everything that had happened that could be category defining in the film, TV show, DVD extra, or whatever it was. They would have time codes, but so that people could go back and check if they needed to. And we would put them into context, explain what was going on, describe the moment, and why we thought it fell at a particular category. Then we would essentially write a paragraph of conclusion saying why we thought the whole work was a particular category and why it would be justified at what we were suggesting. And that would go through and essentially get rubber stamped. If something sounded a bit weird, then a senior examiner might take a look at it. But sometimes we didn't agree. And one of us thought something should be passed to 12, one of us thought it should be 15 or whatever. So if that happened, usually we'd have a bit of a debate and try and convince each other. But if that didn't work, then it would get passed on to a team of three. So then at least you'd hopefully get a tiebreaker and there would be kind of a majority. Often, if there was a contentious issue or something that even might set a new precedent, that would be taken, first of all, it would be seen by senior examiners or possibly the director, but it would also be taken to our weekly examiners meeting. So as I said, we watched for 3.5 days a week. Half a day every week was an examiners meeting where we all got together and talked about any controversial issues that had come up over the last week. Clips would be shown and they would be talked about and put into context. And sometimes classification decisions were made at the meeting where we would have a debate and we would have a show of hands and decide on what category something should go out at. A lot of the time it was just for information. It was the decision had already been made and they were presenting it to you to basically keep up our training so that we kept up to date with any new precedents, any new markers that could affect our decisions moving forward. And that was, again, really important. We were trying to maintain that consistency. So we didn't just kind of have that training and then keep doing the job for years and forget about any, or not know about any new issues that had come up. Other things that could come out of our discussion might be cuts. Sometimes material needed to be cut, and by far the most common of those would be cuts for category. This is where a distributor really wanted a particular category, and they would come to us and say, we need this to be a 12 or whatever, and there would be something in there that didn't fit in that category, so we would tell them what they would need to take out to make it that category. Sometimes that happened in advance. People would come to us while the film was still being completed, and we would do a thing called advice viewings. I remember sitting in a Sony executive's office watching Ghost Rider for advice. And when he asked me if I liked it, I had to lie because it was not good. On the other end of the spectrum, I also went to Twickenham Studios and watched Closing the Ring with Richard Attenborough. And now I can tell people that Richard Attenborough asked for my advice on his final film before releasing it. Compulsory cuts are cuts to material that's not even acceptable at 18. And in almost all cases, that's because it breaches the law. In 2000, one of the things that Robin Duval did when he came in was said that for as far as possible, adults would have the right to choose their own material within the law. And so that meant that the things that are cut at 18 almost always are something which are really potentially harmful for some legal reason or breach some other law, which I'll talk about in a moment. The final option, when cuts wouldn't really address the problem necessarily, was rejection. This is extremely rare these days, and even during the time I worked there. During the 8 years I was at the board, there were no cinema films rejected and only 22 videos, which were pretty much evenly split among sexual violence, violent porn, instructions on growing drugs, and documentaries glorifying kind of real violence or actual death. The fifth day of our schedule was for other work outside of viewing, which supported our job as an examiner. And that could be outreach. So going out to schools, film festivals, giving talks about stuff like this. Or dealing with correspondence. So responding to emails or letters that we got from the public. The examiner who saw the film, who classified the film, would respond to any complaints that we got. Very occasionally, we would respond to praise that we got. It could be keeping up with media effects type research that psychologists were doing, or even doing our own research on public attitudes to things like weapons in films. Or a research project that I was involved in was a long-term study into underage viewing to see to what extent people were seeing material that was categorized at an age higher than theirs, where they were getting that material, where they were having access to it. There was also an opportunity during that time to write new policies if things came up in examining and decisions that were made that we didn't have a written policy for that needed to be done. And also, I think the most important thing really was keeping up to date with precedent setting works. So yes, we'd see some things and we'd see clips of things in meetings, but there were inevitably going to be things that we hadn't classified that were controversial decisions or things that we needed to factor in perhaps going forward. And so some of that time would be used for watching material that we hadn't otherwise had an opportunity to see. So when we were in those meetings and having those examining discussions with our viewing partners or just making the decisions on our own, what were the factors that we needed to look at? First of all, there was legislation. There's a lot of laws that impacted on what we did, but the main ones really were the Obscene Publications Act of 1959, which didn't come up a huge amount during my time there, but it required us to kind of be aware of what the police considered obscene. And it was still a feature of our discussion sometimes. It's a fairly high bar because according to the law, it requires that a work taken as a whole has a tendency to deprave or corrupt a significant portion of those who see it. So that's a difficult bar to reach, but in practice, it was more about what the prosecution service or the police might consider obscene and making sure that we at least could let distributors know that they were getting close to that or in some cases have to cut things. One that did come up from time to time, unfortunately, was the cinematograph film's Animals Act of 1937, which is basically the law against animal cruelty. Actually, it doesn't specifically legislate against animal cruelty. What it does is it makes it illegal to show any scene that is orchestrated or directed by the filmmaker for the purpose of the film that involves actual cruelty to animals, that it shows the cruel infliction of pain or terror or the cruel goading of any animal to fury. And sadly, this did come up from time to time. A lot of older films, particularly, especially Westerns, were cut. One interesting film that was discussed with regard to this law was Almodovar's Talk to Her in 2002, where one of the characters in the film is a matador. And so there were some bullfighting scenes in the film. And when we watched it, it looked very much like the actress in the film was involved in those scenes. And therefore, obviously, those scenes must have been orchestrated and directed by the filmmaker. So we talked to the distributor at the time and said, look, this is probably going to be an issue. It's probably going to have to be cut. You know, bullfights are legal in Spain, but that doesn't really make a difference to our law here on film. And if the actress was involved, it's obvious that they were orchestrated and it involved cruelty to animals. But they actually came back to us and provided us with a significant amount of information on how they filmed those scenes. And what they did was they went along to a training session for a new matador that was already happening. It was already kind of, they didn't have anything to do with setting it up. And they filmed that happening. And they later on filmed the actress in the ring on her own with no bull in the ring. And they, for some shots, superimposed the actress's face onto the matador. This was in 2002. It's long before deepfakes or anything like that. So we were really pretty impressed that they'd managed to do this. But they showed us a great deal of kind of behind the scenes footage, all of the kind of the process of how they went about doing it. And they proved to us that essentially they hadn't done anything that contravened this law. So that film went out uncut. The fact that we had the cinematograph film's Animals Act in 1937 says a lot, I think, about what British people think about their animals, because we didn't get the Protection of Children Act until 1978. And that, again, was an issue that had to be talked about sometimes. We had to occasionally get proof of age. This was an act that prevented indecent images of children, essentially. We sometimes had to get proof of age of actors or actresses who looked young, who were in films or scenes where that would be an issue if they were children. Other laws that came up less frequently were things like the Race Relations Act, laws about indecent exposure, even blasphemous libel until it was repealed. But all of those laws and issues had to be balanced with the Human Rights Act of 1998 and the right to freedom of expression. So it wasn't always as simple as just kind of cutting anything that looked like on face value it might contravene a law. We had to make sure that we were cutting the absolute minimum amount of material that we could in order to bring that work within the law, in order to kind of balance that with the filmmaker's freedom of expression, which was also protected essentially by just another law. Beyond legislation, obviously we had to look at the specific classification issues. Now, one of those that you may not necessarily think about when thinking about classification is the theme or tone of a film. This is where it might not specifically have a moment in it where there's some sex or violence or anything like that which causes a problem at a particular category, but just how the whole film is generally, what it's about sometimes. An example would be The Others from 2001, which there's a couple of jump scares in the film. But there's no violence, no sex, no bad language, no issues really that would be a problem even at the lowest categories. But it's a very creepy, spooky film about ghosts and stuff like that. And so that was past 12 for that, for the tone of the film, essentially. That's a much harder one to kind of write down in some sense. And that's why it became, you know, knowing the precedent, knowing what other things had been passed in the past at 12 and at PG became important. Other kinds of themes or topics that might be an issue on their own would be treatment of things like race or domestic violence, racism, I mean, or domestic violence. Those are kinds of things that unless they're treated incredibly carefully and responsibly, parents just won't expect to see those issues dealt with in children's films, for example. There are certainly ways to do it, and there are children's films that have controversial issues, and certainly many films at 12, I mean, The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, for example, things like that deal with very controversial, very difficult issues. There's a Benigni film called Life is Beautiful, which again deals with the Holocaust in a way that is suitable for children, but it's complicated, and context comes into it a great deal. Language is an issue which has always been important to British people, and it's a very divisive issue. Some people are offended by words that other people are not offended by, and so it's a difficult one to get right for everybody. And in the public consultations that have happened over time, there has been a shift in how much language, bad language, use of fuck, for example, people are allowed or expect to hear, or think that it's okay for their children to hear at different categories. Context really factors in here again, because you can use the word fuck, for example, in so many different ways that there you can't necessarily just say that's one use of fuck that causes that category, possibly a bad example, because you won't get any kind of use of fuck at PG. There was a time where one use of fuck would be okay at 12, and any more than that would be a 15, but that isn't the case anymore, and that is very much about context. If it's sexualized, if it's aggressive, if it's directed at a person and repeated, then again, that might take something to 15. But in some contexts, you will get multiple uses, even at 12. The King's Speech was one where I think the consumer advice for that film said several uses of strong language in a speech therapy context. And again, that's because there was no aggression, no direction at someone, no sexualization of it. It was the word was being used for a particular purpose, and within the context of the film, that was seen as okay for 12. On the other hand, sometimes fuck would be a useful way of getting a film a 12 when otherwise it wasn't going to. Like The Avengers, not that Avengers, the one in 1998, which was the movie version of the British TV show, that was basically a PG film. But they didn't want a PG for it, they wanted a 12. So they put a fuck in, and that got it a 12. So that happens from time to time. People are essentially kind of gaming the system in a way. There are some horror films which were not scary enough to get an 18, and they wanted an 18 because that's kind of badge of honor for a horror film. And so they would put in some sex that made it an 18. So yeah, that was something that came up from time to time. Speaking of sex, that's obviously an issue at every category. At the lower categories, it's still about sex references, which is what took Mrs. Doubtfire to 12. At the upper categories, there's not very much that will be cut in the right context. You can have real sex on screen in an 18 non-porn film, and that has happened many times. Drugs are an issue, again, that troubled the British public in a way that I think was unexpected by the board in the late 90s, early 2000s. And through the public consultations, the board's stance on drugs has got stronger. The public were more concerned about it than the board were at that time. At the lower categories, it's about drugs references. At the higher categories, it's about site of drug use, sometimes site of drug preparation. If it's particularly instructional, it is something that can still even be cut at 18. And if it's particularly glamorous as well, it potentially could cause cuts at the higher categories. There was a film called 13 in 2003, which is a very, very good, very interesting film about essentially kind of a pair of wayward teenagers. And we really would have liked to have passed that film at least at 15, certainly not at 18, ideally, because there was a lot in there for teenagers and for parents of teenagers that they could relate to and get discussion points out of and appreciate, I think. But there was a scene early on of the two leads indulging in substance abuse. And it was totally uncritical in every way. They had a great deal of fun. There was no negative effects whatsoever. And unfortunately, we know that solvent abuse is something which can cause serious harm and even kill people the very first time you try it. So because of that, without any negative effects whatsoever, negative consequences in the film, even though the rest of the film was really very suitable for 15-year-olds, we couldn't put that out at less than 18. Violence is obviously one of the issues that people think about when they think about classification. One film that came up in this category was The Dark Knight, which was past 12, to some controversy, I think it's fair to say. With the 12 guidelines for violence, it's very much about the level of detail that you see. You are allowed to see moderate violence so long as it doesn't dwell on detail. And The Dark Knight really didn't dwell on detail. It's very dark and gritty and kind of intense in places, but the violence is very impressionistic. There's very little blood. There's very little process detail. And it did get a lot of complaints. In fact, it was the most complained about film that year. It got 40% of all of the complaints that the BBFC got that year were about The Dark Knight. But those complaints were immediately following a 3-day campaign by the Daily Mail to complain that the film had got a 12 and that it was unsuitable at 12. And once that campaign ended, the letters very much dropped off. And what we found by kind of analyzing those letters was that a very small number of them, less than 10%, had actually taken children to see the film. And ultimately, it was a film which was kind of edited very quickly, very impressionistic, and it was a high-end 12, but a reasonably solid one. Horror is something that comes up connected to violence often, but it's more about the levels of gore that you see often. And a film like Hot Fuzz, for example, which you might not think of necessarily particularly in terms of gore, there's a few very gory scenes towards the end. But again, we come back to the context. In a much more serious film, in a film like something like Saw or Hostel or stuff like that, if there's a lot of gore, that's going to be a problem and it's going to push a film up to 18. In a film like Hot Fuzz, which is a comedy, it's ridiculous in places, and certainly where the gore happened, it was very ridiculous. There was huge, ridiculous blood spurts, and it was designed to be funny. And because of that, in that context, it was seen as okay at 15. The final thing I'm going to talk about is one of the other main issues that we looked at, which is called imitable techniques. And this is where someone does something or talks about something on screen that if you copied it, if you imitated it, it would be harmful in some way. Now, every examiner at the board had an area of specialism. Be it the 12-15 borderline or drug use or whatever, that they would perhaps pay more attention to the classification issues surrounding that, pay more attention during their one non-viewing day of the week into the research on it, and be more aware of the precedent-setting works. So if that issue came up in a work that needed a second team to look at it, that examiner would usually be put on that second team, so they'd have a little bit more expertise. One of my areas of expertise at the board was imitable techniques. And that meant that sometimes my job was to figure out if MacGyver made a bomb out of fabric conditioner and a paperclip, if that would, first of all, if it would actually work, and secondly, if in attempting to do it, you could get harmed in some other way. Or sometimes it would be the modus operandi of criminals, such as if you could hotwire a car based just on the method that was shown in one episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. One example was the film Fight Club in 1999, where in this scene, Tyler Durden says to the narrator, "Did you know that if you mix equal parts of gasoline and frozen orange juice concentrate, you can make napalm?" That's not true. That you just get very orangey petrol, and that's fine. But there was a film Rutger Hauer film where the hero did explain how to make a kind of napalm, homemade napalm, to another character, and that would have worked. And the police in that instance asked us to not... they basically said it would be good if that wasn't widely dispersed, because a lot of people, a lot of lives are saved because people don't really know how to make an effective Molotov cocktail. And while you can look this stuff up, you can find it on the internet, especially these days, and you know, you can find it online if you go looking for it, not putting that information out there in cinemas and into people's homes is potentially a plus. So that Rutger Hauer film was cut, and sometimes it was about that. It was about cutting a particular part of the process that if you didn't know about that, that wouldn't work then, or doing something in a way that meant it wouldn't cause harm. And this is where I was responsible in part for a kind of offshoot of the Pizzagate conspiracy. Just in case anyone doesn't know, really quick primer on the Pizzagate conspiracy is that it's a conspiracy theory that says that some prominent people, especially in DC, are running a kind of paedophile ring out of the basement of a pizza restaurant, which, as it turns out, doesn't have a basement. And therefore, they think that whenever prominent people talk about pizza in some way or show it on screen or anything like that, that is somehow them hiding in plain sight and, I don't know, expressing support for paedophiles or showing that they are a member of this conspiracy or something like that. And Lilo and Stitch in 2002 had a scene where the little girl, Lilo, hides from her sister in a tumble dryer. And recently, Lilo and Stitch was put on Disney Plus for streaming, and they re-edited the scene. So instead of this, it was this scene here, where Lilo instead hides under a table and has a pizza box to kind of block up the hole and hide her from her sister. And this went around the internet a bit with people saying, look, this is proof that Disney is part of Pizzagate and they have sympathy for paedophiles and they're kind of telling you that they, I don't know, telling you that they support paedophiles in some way. And what else, what other possible reason could there be for this? How could they have put this pizza there if that's not what they're saying? There's no other possible explanation. We've definitely proved it. Well, this was my fault, because in 2002, we looked at that scene where Lilo hid in a tumble dryer. And unfortunately, every year there are a few cases around the world of kids getting into tumble dryers or washing machines, hiding or playing in them and being severely injured or sometimes dying. So we took that seriously and we said, no, this is an activity that is presented as safe in this film. It looks fun and is fine, but it's actually not safe. And we talked to Disney and said, look, are you sure you want to have this in the film? We don't think it's okay at you. We're probably going to cut it even at PG. And they said, not a problem. We will reanimate it. And this is what they did. I don't know why they didn't show this version in the US, but this was the UK version. I also don't know why they chose to upload the UK version to Disney Plus, but this was edited 20 years ago almost. And it's not, as far as I know, Disney don't support that kind of thing at all. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Jim. That was absolutely fantastic. So straight into the Q&A with obviously the best question of the night, because it was asked by me. What was the worst thing that you had to watch, Jim?
Okay, well, I had to watch some pretty bad stuff. Stuff that did end up getting rejected and for very good reason. But to be honest, the only thing I ever had to look away from was the Jackass movie. Because there's a scene where they're giving themselves and each other paper cuts in like the webbing between their fingers. And that freaked me the fuck out. I couldn't keep facing the screen. Fortunately, we were watching it in a pair, so my viewing partner was able to make sure nothing else was happening. But yeah, that's the only thing I ever had to look away from.
And I think with a lot of these things, it is very subjective as to what is for you. Most people would find that quite minor. For you, that was like, no, get me away.
Nope.
No, interesting. Right, we've had a couple of questions around this topic of becoming an examiner. So the first question comes from Anonymous and is, what are the experience requirements to become an examiner?
So As I mentioned, there's a huge range of different backgrounds that examiners had. It has changed more recently. Now they're not even called examiners. They're called compliance officers, I think. And the criteria have changed. So I don't know exactly how it is now. But basically, it was mostly an interest in film with something else to back up some reason why you should also do it. I had a degree in psychology. I'd studied media effects research and stuff like that. So that, and I also had worked at Channel 5. So I kind of came from broadcasting, psychology, kind of a bit of child development, bit of media effects. So I had that background. But really sometimes it was, you know, as I said, a parole officer, for example, we had. So working with kind of young offenders and things like that was a benefit in some ways. Teaching, there were lots of different aspects, and everyone brought their own kind of areas of expertise and specialism to the job, and then hopefully developed kind of skills as they went along.
So you mentioned the lorry driver earlier. What was his special set of skills?
I don't know, to be honest. Not because he wasn't very skilled or very good at the job. It was just that was the job that he'd been doing before. He wasn't, you know, someone who had taken what would seem to be a more traditional route.
And a follow-up question comes from Anonymous. What's the salary like for examiners?
Again, it's changed. It was pretty good. When I was there, it was, starting, I think, around 40 grand. That was pretty good. It was well worth doing for a few years. But they've basically cut it in half. In the last few years with changes to the job and changes to the requirements for examiners. But part of that, I think, was to encourage people who were perhaps sometimes farther along in their careers and had, you know, a range of different experiences to come and do the job. Because if you don't pay very much, then you're not going to get people who are, you know...
You're not going to get psychologists. You're not going to get doctors and lawyers. And I imagine certain things, like doctors in particular, would have certain insight into like medical procedures and that kind of thing as to whether they've just made this extra bloody just for the sake of it.
Yeah, there was always someone to turn to with a question, basically, that might have some expertise.
And I mean, when you mentioned the initial salary, I was about to ask Jack's question as my own question and say, how do I get a job at the BBFC? I want to watch films all day. But let's go with Jack's question and go, how do you get
a job? I mean, there is a vacancies section on the BBFC website. In fact, I recommend the BBFC website to anyone who's at all interested in any of this stuff. They have a lot of PDFs on there of their previous annual reports and the research that they look at when they're doing their, you know, the research they've done as well. And a lot of case studies of specific films to explain why they got the category they got and why that might be. But one of the things they have is a vacancies page. There's no openings at the moment for examiners.
Steve asks, for imitable techniques, Critters rated 15 shows using an aerosol with a flame to create a flamethrower, which I then totally imitated. What's the cutoff?
Yep. Yeah, I also totally did that. I think I saw it in Live and Let Die. Live and Let Die, it has to be said, is a PG. But that was a cigar with an aerosol. That was prior to the overhaul and public consultations of the thing. That was in the 70s. I think that kind of thing would probably be allowed at 15 and 18. It's more about hoping that children won't do it in a way that is likely to cause a problem. Obviously, I don't know what you might have done at 15 if you were even 15 when you saw that. And if you had done it in a safe way, I at least did it in the garden. I didn't kind of do it, you know, near a curtain or something like that. So
I think I did it. I was reasonably,
you know, sensible.
Yeah, I think I'm a school playing field from memory. Andrew asks, in your time as an examiner, what was the film that was the hardest to agree on a classification for?
I mean, there were a lot of films which we just didn't agree on classifications for. Ultimately, someone made the decision. There was it either went to the entire board and we took a kind of show of hands or the director ultimately just made the decision. One fairly prominent one was The Bourne Identity, which ended up being the first 12A. I was on the first team for that, and both of us on that team were absolutely of the opinion that should have been a 15. There was, in our opinion, sufficient dwelling on the detail and process of violence that that a 15 was warranted. I think I remember that the distributor in that case requested a kind of appeal viewing, and that it would be seen by more people because they really wanted the 12. And the number of cuts we would have needed to make, I thought, to make it a 12 were over the top, perhaps. It was viewed by a couple of other teams and the director at the time, and ultimately decided on a 12. I disagreed with that, but that's the thing. You don't win every game. Yep. So
it is down to a consensus view. And as we said earlier, one thing that you can find really upsetting or really disturbing, somebody else might go, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
I don't see that. The next question is going to be a little series of questions because we've got a number of questions around the same topic. And having spoken to you during the break, I know you have a bit of an insight into this specifically, which is around computer games. So the first question is, Anonymous asks, how does rating a video game work? How long would it take? Do you have to play 100% completion to make sure you didn't miss a particularly gruesome murder?
Okay, so I led the team that classified video games, and I would have, if it had been a longer talk, I might have gone into detail on this. But basically, there were only, I think, at the most part, 8 of us who actually were gamers during my time there. And so they didn't expect examiners who didn't know how to play video games to classify video games. Because you're coming at it with, you know, a lot of, first of all, knowledge and skills, and actually being able to just get through the games. Unlike some other classification bodies, we did actually play every game. We were given cheat codes often, God mode if possible, but anything that could help us get through. We were sometimes given saved games so we could skip between different levels. But the answer really is that practically we accepted that we would never be able to see everything in a game. Certainly for some games, just playing each of the missions in, I think, GTA 4 probably would take about 50 hours. And that's not counting all of the other stuff you can do.
Yeah.
So generally it would be a day with two examiners, and we'd play as much as we could. We would get a sense of what the game mechanics were. So what you were able to do and what you were being asked to do by the game.
Would you both play the game, or would one of you play, one of you watch?
Or take it in turns.
Take it in turns.
Yeah. So you get a sense of what the game's about and what the general tone and the type of things you're able to do. A game, for example, like Mass Effect, which was a kind of controversial game because, I mean, it was incredible, sprawling game that you could do all kinds of different things. One of the things you could do, given the right decision tree of kind of options that you chose, was trigger a sex scene. And that caused problems in the US. Didn't cause that much of a problem for us because the sex scene was reasonably mild. If that sex scene had been interactive, if you'd been able to kind of do something during the sex, that might have been a problem because no parent wants to go in and into a room and see their 12-year-old simulating sex in a game. But what happened was it was like a conversation tree of things where if you said the right things, that happened and it was a cut scene. So for us, it was about what was the level of detail in that scene. And that was 12 level detail. There really wasn't anything. So, it was playing the game to the extent that we could, understanding how the game worked, what it was asking you to do and what kinds of things it showed. And often the distributors would let us know about kind of if there was anything that they thought was particularly strong, because it was never in their interest to kind of play it. And, you know, yeah, they might get a bit of publicity out of it, but equally there was a possibility that the game could be recalled and they'd have to take it off the shelves if there was a serious problem that they'd kind of tried to get past us in some way.
And also, if they've misled you then, you're more likely to be harsher on them the next time. Not because you're just going, you've been dicks to me, I'm going to be a dick to you. More because you go, well, I don't know what they've hidden in here. They hid things from me last time. The tone of the game is a 15-18. Well, actually, because I don't know what they've hidden in it, I'm going to say it's an 18 just because they've probably hidden something else from me. Lee Ashcroft asked specifically about the game Manhunt 2. Why was it banned? Why was it eventually classified? Did the BBFC get it wrong?
Manhunt 2 was an interesting one. We classified Manhunt at 18. And in fact, I can talk about this because when I was interviewed several times about this, it was sub judice at the time, so I couldn't actually talk about much of it. But I went to Rockstar's offices along with the director of the board at the time, David Cook, and my senior examiner to watch scenes from the game and have Rockstar kind of walk us through some stuff for Manhunt 2 before it was getting ready to be classified, because they wanted advice. They wanted to see where we sat on it and what we thought about it. At the time, we all said it was 18, and we didn't really have much of a problem with it. By the time it came into the board, not much had changed about it, and the examiners who saw it first said that they thought it was 18, but because it was definitely going to be a controversial decision, because Manhunt itself was, it did go to another team, and the director had another look at it. By that point, something in his thinking had changed, and the decision at that point was that it was, I think the phrase was, unremittingly bleak and callous, and that it was unsuitable for classification. They then resubmitted with some of the kind of stronger moments cut out, and because we'd already essentially given them the ruling that it was the tone generally of the game that was the problem, the cuts they'd made didn't address that. So then, even though it was by this point really clearly an 18, we couldn't go back on the reject because they hadn't addressed the reason for rejecting it in making the cuts. So yes, it was appealed by under the Video Appeals Committee at the time. I believe they got the 18. And yes, if I had to say, I would say that the BBFC did make a mistake in that classification. I don't think it was a reject, really.
Do you think you've made any mistakes in the past?
Oh, absolutely. I'm sure I have. Yeah. I can't think of any right now. But yeah, I mean, the thing is, as you say, we are viewers as well as examiners. We have an emotional reaction to stuff that we see. Some stuff feels stronger than others. I can't think of an example that I regretted particularly.
I'd also imagine your frame of mind at the time will affect.
Sure.
You know, if you've just gone through something, that particular thing might hit you harder than it would have done normally.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah.
But again, working in pairs, that probably helps to counteract some of your own biases that are creeping in.
Hopefully,
from.
Yeah, that's part of that. And also part of the benefit of viewing in pairs is kind of emotional support as well. Because some of the stuff you see is pretty nasty, and kind of not having to do that in a room on your own is a benefit.
And I mean, I know we've heard about this with Facebook reviewers, with what the content moderation for Facebook, which is outsourced, and them talking about the lack of support they get in terms of the mental trauma of some of the things that get reported to them, and they have to sit there and watch it.
Yeah.
And I mean, the stories coming out of there are horrific, and I can imagine.
We did at one point. They did make a therapist available to us if we needed one, which the main outcome of that was an article or a small piece, I think in the Times, which the headline was Dawn to Dusk Sex Puts Sensors in Therapy, which I've still got somewhere. But you had to be reasonably robust to do the job. And we had that support network of other examiners. We could at any point pause something and walk away and come back to it. There were techniques in place to make it copable with.
So carrying on from the computer game topic, Igor asks, are the rules consistent across media? Are games, films, short videos, song lyrics, porn, are they all judged by the same standards?
they are largely judged by the same standards, although there are differences that are inherent because of the media. With games, for example, when you're talking about frequency of strong language, if, again, certainly at the times where you would only be allowed one or two uses of fuck in a 12 film, if someone on a street corner in a game says fuck, and you can walk back and past that person multiple times and hear it each time, then yeah, that's going to possibly put it up to a 15. If there are instructional details of how to do something potentially dangerous in a film, but it's kind of quick and done, then that might be one category. Whereas if your mission in the game is to do that and it shows you how to do it and that would work in real life, again, that could potentially be another category. They're very different ways of experiencing media. And so, yeah, they can mean that the category is different. With film and video, the 1994 Criminal Justice and Public Order Act amended the Video Recordings Act to require us to pay particular attention to harm through viewing in the home. And essentially that meant largely that there was less potential for definitely restricting it outside of the hands of children. So there was potential for even adult material to get into the hands of children. That was overturned by a legal case later in the 2000s. Also the fact that you can stop and rewind and watch something again, especially for instructional stuff, made video potentially more dangerous for some elements than a film. If you go into the cinema, you can't, you know, you watch it and it's done.
Yeah, can't rewind. Video games, you can also change the angle so that if you can't see what's going on from somewhere, well, you can watch it from a different angle and that might give you more information.
Yeah, it depends on the mechanics of the game and how that works. But yeah, absolutely, that's another thing that could have an effect.
Carrying on in this same topic, we've got Steel Wolf, also known as Don, is asking, is animation judged by the same criteria as live action? And if not, what criteria are they judged on?
I would say yes, they are judged the same. Although that is based on the fact that all the judgments include context. So if it's like 2D animation and like cell animation, it's unlikely to look as scary, gory, sexy as a live action person. It depends on the style of animation. I mean, what I would say is there's Japanese animation, for example, that was rejected. There's a film called Urutsuka Doji 4, Legend of the Overfiend, which I believe was rejected. And again, I think mostly the Japanese animation that was rejected was about sexual violence and stuff like that, which is still a... in terms of media effects, most of the most robust evidence for there potentially being a danger to society or to the individual through watching some material comes in the social sexual violence area. For every piece that says violent films make people violent, there's another piece that says no, they don't. And if you look at the data and like go into the research that's been done and kind of see what the end numbers are and all of that kind of stuff, that it doesn't really hold up, except for when you get to sexual violence, where there is more robust data. So that has always been, or has been taken more seriously in the last couple of decades, and I suspect will continue to be so. So where it's content that leads to rejections, that's usually what it is. And that is true of animation as of live action stuff.
So I'm going to sort of tie that question into another question by me saying that the other thing with animation is that it's very easy to blur things in animation, and blurring things in animation for comedic value can work very well when you know exactly what's behind that blurring and they're just doing it to make fun out of censors, which happened specifically on, I think it was South Park, but I think Family Guy might also have done it, around the viewing of Muhammad. And this links into the next question, which is, how would the BBFC handle a film that contained a depiction of the Prophet Muhammad?
It's a question I don't know the answer to, but my suspicion is that it would be treated in the same way as any other person. I don't think that they, I mean, there wouldn't be much point in just raising the category because it's either on screen or it isn't. And that's the issue. I'd be very surprised if they cut that at 18. Again, it's possible. I don't know what their current stance would be. It's not an issue that came up when I was there, but I'd be very surprised if that was the way that it was treated. I think it would also not have much of an effect.
Interesting to be the fly on the wall on the director's office wall when he's having that discussion with the team and discussing exactly what they think. I think it'd be a very interesting conversation. I also think it would be a very publicised conversation. Garnet asks, do you know if other countries approach film classification in a similar manner, or are they vastly different to the BBFC?
I would say that the BBFC is these days at least probably the most transparent. But different countries have different levels of kind of connection to the industry itself. And are viewed differently. I mean, the MPAA, for example, in America, they are not viewed with kindness by the industry much, and they only do cinema films. There's no real classification for videos in the US. And I mean, there's the Italian Film Board have always traditionally been extremely liberal in what they allow, and quite political in places as well. There's differences, and there's differences I think also because the societies are different, because what, you know, when we looked at what British people think, it's different to what French people think. You know, the British people traditionally are more uptight about sex than some Europeans, for example. We're going to treat things differently. In terms of how they go about the job, I suspect most do it in much the same way.
Dave M. asks, what issues were the hardest to agree amongst examiners? Was this usually consistent, or different examiners have particular bugbears?
Definitely individual examiners had their own things that they found particularly troublesome or sometimes wished could be at a different category. We were all involved during our time there in rewriting sets of guidelines. So those kinds of things would come up for debate during those periods. Issues that caused a lot of debate. To some extent, everything. I can't think of anything that really stands out as being a particularly debatable topic. There was a lot of debate around the borderline of between different categories, around whether something was okay, right at that PG-12 borderline or the 12-15 borderline. And people had different views on that. So for every issue, I think we talked about that a lot. I can't think of one that was specifically something that always caused a problem.
How were the pairings done for the examiners? Did they sort of come up with somebody more liberal and somebody more conservative, or was it just random?
How were the what, sorry?
Pairings of the pairs.
Oh, right. Oh, no, it was completely random.
Random. So you could end up with two people.
Because I mentioned we had some films that would be from Bollywood, for example. So we would always have a member of the Hindi-speaking examiners, for example, on there, but not two. So it would always be one person who was not from that background and one person who understood the culture of the film as well as the language.
And then they have it subtitled for the...
They would interpret for the non-Hindi-speaking examiner. Where that was the case, then there would be a kind of a weighting of the randomness in that direction. But no, for average stuff, it was completely random. And you knew who you were going to be viewing with before you knew what you were going to be viewing.
Okay.
And they were done separately. The only thing that where it was changed was, as I mentioned, in kind of second teams where something had already been seen and was controversial for a particular reason, then someone who worked in that area particularly would be put on that team.
Garnet again asks, were you exempt from the Obscene Publications Act for your initial screenings, or were you required by law to report anything that could transgress it?
Do you mean like when, for the fact that we saw it? Okay.
Yeah.
That's a good question. My understanding at least is that at the time that we were seeing it, it hadn't been published. So the Obscene Publications Act, I don't recall the exact wording of the bill. But I think that the work had to have been published in order to technically break the law. So we were an early part of that process.
Yeah.
Essentially. So I don't think it was an issue, and no, we didn't report stuff because we were telling them that they weren't allowed to put it out there, essentially.
And it hadn't been broadcast, and therefore it wasn't in breach of that until they published it, which they wouldn't do because they wouldn't be allowed to because you told them not to.
Exactly.
And on a follow-up to that, Anonymous asks, are you under any kind of NDA for what you watch?
Yes. There were many times where there was like an embargo of information, really, rather than an NDA so much. It was about when things, for example, like the first Harry Potter film came in, there were security guards that brought that and stood to make sure no one else got to go in and see it other than the examiners.
I mean, you'd understand it. I mean, certain films, the plot twists themselves are the film.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, there was an expectation of confidentiality from the clients, which is completely reasonable. So yeah, we wouldn't have talked about anything. And in fact, when the BBFC put out their decisions on what films contained and what categories they were at, it would be within a certain period of the release of the film, so that there wasn't, you know, problems there.
Hassan asks, I once heard there are British rules against subliminal messages. Does that apply to movies, and were there any cases?
There are cases of subliminal images in films, but it's not. There was a rumor in the 60s of if you put kind of drink Coke, eat popcorn for a frame in a film, then people will leave the cinema and go and buy a Coke and some popcorn. That was never really true. It was never the apparent research that was done on it was either, I can't remember if it was faked or just extremely poor research. But it was never really a thing. That said, there are films which contain single frames of problematic material. Fight Club is one that kind of flags it up. They talk about it. Tyler Durden mentions it, and then there are multiple frames later on throughout the film that show the kinds of things he was talking about after describing the process. There's an Al Pacino film. I forget the name. It could be Panic in Needle Park, but there's others as well that had used a similar technique, had individual frames of things. Yeah, that's an issue. And if those single frames caused a category issue, then the category would be decided based on those unless the distributor wanted to take them out. But not because of worries about people being subliminally affected so much as just it's material that's in the thing that we've been asked to classify.
Did you have the opportunity to pause and go back on things?
On video, absolutely.
Yeah.
On film, there was a separate machine in another room that if we needed to look at something again, the film, because it came in reels of film, and so we had a couple of projectors in the projection booth, and they couldn't because of basically if you stop a film in front of a bulb, even safety film, it doesn't catch light these days, fortunately, but it will destroy the film. So they would put it onto another machine, and because we'd noted which reel it was and which moment through the reel, we could scroll through and look at it again.
Andrew asks a question that's sort of been asked already, but I'm going to add a bit to it. So does watching all sorts of films, including some difficult material, have an emotional toll on examiners and their health, which you sort of covered a little bit already? Did people leave because of it as well?
I think I know of one person who left partly because of it. I don't think she was particularly happy just generally at the board. So I think it was a factor that led into the consideration. But yeah, it was an issue that the interview process was intense and featured a reasonable amount of quite problematic material in that process to before yeah. we got to the point where they were kind of seeing if we were right to do the job. So that if that was going to put people off, it did, I'm sure. And initially when I started in 2001, the kind of soft rule was that it was a 5-year job. And I think up to that point, most people were kind of either moving on or doing something else within 5 years. It got stretched, and I know people who were doing it for more than 12 years. But that was the idea. The theory was that, you know, if this kind of stuff affects people, it must affect us as well. I think the fact is there's some truth to that probably, but also we were watching it in a very specific context. A lot of the more problematic stuff, a lot of the adult material, the violent stuff that was really potentially traumatizing in a way, was watched with other people in the context of looking at it for particular reasons. It wasn't experienced in the same way as someone does, you know, sitting at home or with a video or in the cinema. And it was, especially if it was looked at in meetings, for example, it was a completely different kind of environment. Yeah. So,
and yeah. I mean, it also wasn't all of it. That wasn't the whole job. You were also
watching
some lighthearted, you know, some stuff that, is it a PG or is it a 12?
It's a lot movies that I wouldn't have chosen to watch as well.
Are you going to tell us the other story that you told us during the break about your favourite film that you got to watch?
My favourite, what was that?
Cars.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I classified the Blu-ray of Cars, which is my least favourite Pixar film. I love Pixar films generally, but for reasons we could go into, but I won't. I don't like Cars. And the Blu-ray of Cars has obviously the film. It also has audio commentaries of the film. It has text commentaries. It has like 6 or 7 different versions of the film and then loads of features. And you have to watch everything. And so I was watching Cars for a good 3 days. And there's a point at which you think, oh, my God, give me something really nasty to watch instead. I'd rather do that.
It's not the easiest job. Sometimes there are challenges, including watching 3 days of Cars. Sirdar asks, is there pressure for more diversified categorization, e.g. issues related to culture, identity, racism, LGBT issues, etc.?
Yeah, there is. That's definitely something which is considered. And I think it was introduced into the guidelines. I can't remember if it was the last set, which was 2019, or the previous set, which was 2014, I think. Possibly even the 2010 guidelines. But it was introduced as a specific category issue, discrimination and how it's handled on screen. Yes, discriminatory language, racial epithets, things like that are treated as language, as strong language, and treated harshly. And a lot of how racism, discrimination or things like that are allowed at the lower categories would be based on the treatment of them, based on the context, if they're disapproved of, you know, how it plays out in the whole work.
Could things get removed just based on their theme in terms of if it is a pro white supremacy
yeah.
film? Would that
Absolutely.
Have it be?
Yeah, I mean, the Race Relations Act is still a part of what the board considers at 18. And yeah, hate speech would not be allowed in a film in a context where that is what's being glorified or being pushed as the right thing to do. So yeah, absolutely, it could make a difference even at 18.
There are some fantastic films out there containing racism, sure. but that's they're not it's glorifying the it. It's exactly. I mean, Malcolm X. Am I getting the right name? Yeah. No, American History X.
Oh, American History X. Yeah.
That's
problematic for lots of reasons. But yes, there's a fairly nasty attack scene.
Yes,
there is. Which I think was category defining on its own. And then at the level that was taken to, the racism was seen to be an acceptable part of that.
Yeah.
Or yeah, if that's the right way.
Again, it's not glorifying it. So it is about actually that gruesome attack is far more of an issue than the context of the racism, because the racism has not been glorified.
No, it's interesting. Pretty clearly denounced.
Yep. Alistair asks, what's it like having to classify actual pornography, or does the BBFC no longer do that?
They do it still. It's actually about 25% of what you see. Or at least it was when I was there. I don't know what the numbers are these days, but it's pretty boring, to be honest. It really is very boring because it goes on for a long time. And for the most part, it's the material that gets cut the most, because there's 18 porn and there's R18 porn. 18 is stuff you can buy on video and DVD in the high street. R18 you can only buy in a licensed sex shop if it's on video or DVD, and that's basically hardcore stuff, the softcore stuff Channel 5 might have shown of an evening would be 18. Obviously everyone gets it online these days, so I don't really know why people are still going to licensed sex shops. But the 18 stuff, they always tried to fly as close to the wind as possible. So there were a lot of category cuts for that. So sometimes it was very clinical and just kind of looking at whether this angle means that they could possibly not really be doing it, or whether it's obvious that they're really doing it. And that's the point at which you need to make the cut. Whereas for R18, the cuts were more to do with them getting potentially violent or harmful in various ways, or non-consensual in some instances. So that was less clinical, more upsetting sometimes. But it's about watching for that borderline the whole time.
I know that pardon me, there was some discussion in the chat earlier about how it seemed a little bit weird to go to work and sit in a room with another person and sit and watch porn all day.
It's pretty weird.
Not your normal day. Okay. Moving on. You used the words depraved and corrupt in the talk, and Anonymous would like to know, what exactly does that mean?
Great question. I'd like to know what that means too. It's the wording of the Obscene Publications Act. They do clarify, actually, in the Obscene Publications Act, they say any work taken as a whole that has a tendency to deprave or corrupt, i.e. make morally bad,
that really helps
a significant proportion of those who are likely to see it. So yeah, that's what it means. It means it will make you morally bad. It's pretty much impossible to nail that down. And so the application of the OPA in practice is very much about what are the kinds of things that the Crown Prosecution Service are likely to bring a case against. And those things get cut or sent back to the distributor. So it's interpreting that is a folly, really.
Okay. Alistair asks, how many films are still unrated / banned by the BBFC, and how often does that happen?
If you're talking about specifically films, I don't know a number, but in over the last probably 30 years, I would say it's single figures. Obviously, a lot were banned prior to that, in James Furman's time, in John Trevelyan's time, and going back then. And if those films have since been resubmitted, a lot of them have then been unbanned and given a classification. I don't know what the number is for films that were rejected and have never been resubmitted or never been classified. I believe there's a Wikipedia page on that, though. And I would expect it to be in the region of kind of maybe 50, something like that. But it's not a massive number, because a lot of, if there's any money in it, distributors put the banned films back into circulation once they could.
And also, potentially, if it's a banned film, you as the classifiers will be giving them information on why, and potentially they just would cut a few scenes and go, actually, fine, we can cut down the gratuitous violence, or we can stop seeing the head rolling down the street. We can, and then playing football, we'll just leave it at the head getting cut off.
I mean, certainly over the last 30 years, it would be a rejection would not have been given for something that could have been cut. If there was material in a film which was really problematic and needed cutting, we would recommend cutting that material and say you can have an 18 if you do that. The things that have been cut are things where the whole work is problematic for usually the same reason. I mean, to give you a quite mild example, there was a slew of films in 2005, I think. Videos, these were not cinema films, that were about how to grow weed. And that was against the law. And there was, you know, essentially that because that was against the law, we rejected the works because that was all it was about. So
you can't cut a bit
there was
of
nothing
that
you
and
could
go,
cut.
Oh.
Yeah, there was nothing that would make that an okay film at 18 at the time. I don't know that they would even be cut now. But yeah, things like that, or some films that were just a repetition of actual scenes of people dying, for example. To be honest, some of those, depending on the context and the presentation, did get classified at 18. There are films like that out there, but there are also films that were cut, rejected for that reason. And the reason they were rejected was because of the constant focus on it, and cutting any individual moment wouldn't have made a difference.
Anonymous asks, why did Star Trek II Wrath of Khan get a 15 rating originally, then go down to a PG? And how often does reclassifying occur?
So Star Trek II, this is one of the great case studies on the BBFC website. So you should look at the BBFC, because they'll give you more information than me. But according to them, the film was actually passed A in 1982, because it was passed in May of 1982, and the new categories didn't come in until later in that year. So it wasn't technically a 15 at the time. And then when that cut was released on video, it was passed PG, because that was, 10 years later. So the rules had changed essentially on what those things that were a problem at the time or would part. Well, in fact, there was only U, A, and double A and X at the time. So A was essentially PG, really.
Yeah.
But it was cut for A. It wasn't passed uncut. There was apparently a shot of a slug crawling bloodily out of Chekhov's ear that was cut. But an uncut AA was proposed, apparently. So, yeah, look at the BBFC website. It's got some good stuff on there.
So the films that were classified as A, or were they all eventually reclassified into the modern standards, or were they automatically regraded to a...
No, it's only if they were resubmitted. So
there are films that are still...
Well, on film, yes. So theoretically, and it would be a weird situation, I don't know how they'd work it. I don't actually know. It's a good question. I don't know if they could release a film at A now. Because it was past A before. But video, the new system of UPG 15, 18 and so on had come in before the Video Recordings Act. So videos have always been based on basically the same system. And again, the 94 Criminal Justice and Public Order Act gave the BBFC the right to reclassify videos if necessary, if they were resubmitted, and increase the rating, because before that, they basically kind of had to live with the precedent. But it was, again, only on the basis that viewing in the home might have greater harm. But yeah, I mean, it's films that were passed at lower or earlier categories aren't automatically upgraded or changed to the newer category. They'd have to be resubmitted.
I'm just thinking of cinemas that play classic films, and there are cinemas out there. Potentially there are films out there being played as A's or as...
I I would be surprised if they're not resubmitted, or that many of those have been resubmitted in the past. I mean, I saw the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde from the 30s when I was there for a cinema release, and downgraded it from, I think it was an X to PG. It was very nearly a U.
Wow. We are getting on a little bit, so we've got we're going to try and limit it to a couple more questions, okay, because it is now 10 to 9 already, and we've kept you for a couple of hours already. So Hot Fuzz loses one of its funniest scenes whenever it's shown on TV, even when shown late at night, when Nick Frost says the C word. What's the reasoning for this?
Well, the rules for TV are different to the rules for film. And the answer to that is, I don't really know. I don't know why they would do that, because I don't think that's necessarily even the only use of that word in the film. I think there might be three. I'm pretty sure there's three uses in Hot Fuzz. Arguably one of them is written down, but yeah, the rules are different for TV, and it may be as simple as that's the version they were given by the distributors. Or it may be that is a cut that the TV channel decided to make, because they were showing it at an earlier time at one point and they showed the same version. Many reasons they could do that, but no, the rules are, they're related because they're based on the same kind of research, but they're different for different mediums.
Steve asks a really interesting question, one that I'm fascinated by. How do you classify something like a pantomime, which often has lots of sex references, but they go over the heads of children?
Well, for the most part, that would still be allowed at a child's category. I mean, if you look at any of the Carry On films, most of those are PG, probably, I think. In fact, Mrs. Doubtfire, which was originally past 12 by the board, had only a couple of things cut in order to make it a PG. And there's still a great deal of sex references in that. The ruling for that and the reason why they passed it PG was that kids wouldn't understand them. They wouldn't know that they were sex references.
And there's a lot of cartoons out there where there are sex references that if you watch them with your kids or with your nieces and nephews, you watch them, you're laughing at different parts of the kids. Absolutely. The kids are laughing at the inane jokes, the, you know, really innocuous ones. And then the adults are there, that means something else. Anonymous asks, does the reliance on precedent risk conserving outdated moral attitudes, e.g. views on same-sex affection, has changed a lot in the last decade?
I can see how you could think that, but no, because precedent is a starting point, where situations shift and the way people think about things shifts, again, along with every 4 to 5 years, the new public consultation and the new rewriting of the guidelines, things do change. And so the ultimately the first point of contact essentially is the guidelines. It's people, the examiners look at that and say, okay, does this film fit in with those? And those guidelines change over time, with something like the approach to homosexuality, it's explicit in the guidelines that homosexuality is treated the same as heterosexuality. There's no difference at all. What the precedent helps is to make sure that we're not going to do something too surprising, too out there, and that people can kind of get to know what a category means and use that information going forwards. But it doesn't mean that nothing will change, and things do change over time. Drugs, as I said, the treatment of drugs has got harsher. The treatment of language has got less harsh. And certainly in the early 2000s, the treatment of sexual activity in the 15 and 18 got a lot less harsh, because that was what the public said that they felt was appropriate.
So I am going to finish off with possibly the weirdest, most unusual, the most, I don't know how to put this, I never thought I'd say these words, put it that way. Would you rather watch 6 hours of Teletubbies or 6 hours of porn?
That's a really difficult question, actually. It honestly, it really depends on the porn. I have had to watch 6 hours of Teletubbies. I've had to watch 6 hours of Bob the Builder and Dora the Explorer. And much of this was before I had a kid. And then having to watch them also with my child was kind of torture. One of the things I found hardest with Teletubbies was keeping my focus, and paying attention, because it makes you want to switch your brain off. With porn, you are constantly looking for the thing that might need cutting. But with something like that, because there's so rarely any kind of issue, there's an episode of Bob the Builder where Bob is wallpapering Wendy's house, and the wallpaper, he's very bad at it. It's a very kind of Mr. Bean type thing. And the wallpaper falls over his face, and it really sounds, if you really listen out for it, that you can hear Bob saying fuck, like muffled by the wallpaper. And so you can't not listen for stuff like that and not pay attention, but it is really difficult to maintain focus for that amount of time with something so banal.
I also seem to recall there's a lot of sexual innuendo in Teletubbies. It, again, for adults,
there are bits
that adults get. Yeah, that's that's funny because it is a sex joke, but it's,
I mean, Tubby Custard just on its own is, yeah,
exactly. And it's aimed at 4 year olds or however old children are when they watch Teletubbies, but it's aimed at an age that is never going to understand these jokes. But for the adults, they've got to try and put a bit in there for us. Right. That was our last question, because I don't think any question can follow that. That is the ultimate finishing question. That was absolutely amazing. Thank you so much, Jim. But not to forget the people behind the scenes. So tonight's tech was Laurie, with Matty backing him up. And with Gerald backing up for me and managing the Slido, and also not to forget our fantastic mods. Thank you, guys. We can't do this without you. Next week we have Incredulous with Andy Wilson and his guests. If you haven't seen it or heard it before, most of our previous talks are available on our YouTube channel, and Incredulous in particular is also its entire own podcast. We're shortly going to open the doors to our virtual pub, the Lock-ins Razor, which you can join by visiting sitp.online/virtualpub. The link will be in the chat, and I will see you all in the pub or next week. Thank you very much.